Welcome to Babbel, Translating the Middle East, a podcast from the Middle East program at CSIS. Here on Babbel, we take you beyond the headlines to take a closer look at what's happening in the Middle East and why it matters.
In a special episode of Babbel this week, John welcomes two guests, Marcina Shamri and Hamza Haddad, to talk about how the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq altered the course of Iraq and their own lives. Then, John, Will, and I continue the conversation, discussing diaspora experiences in a broader context.
To translate some of what's happening in the Middle East, this is Babbel. Marcina Shamri is soon to be an assistant professor at Boston College. She's a research fellow with the Middle East Initiative at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. She worked at Brookings, and she recently got her PhD from MIT. Her husband, Hamza Haddad, is an adjunct fellow with the Middle East Security Program at the Center for New American Security and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Marcin and Hamza, thanks for joining us again on Babbel.
Absolutely, our pleasure.
Thanks for having us, John.
20 years ago, the U.S. went into Iraq, forced Saddam Hussein from power. Where were you both 20 years ago?
Yeah, I was in Canada. That's where I was born and raised. I was 9 when the war happened. Remember it like yesterday. I was young, but the television set was always on the news, mostly American news. I remember April 9th when the fall of the regime happened and the toppling of the statue in Fardos Square. And I actually found myself a few months later in Baghdad with my mother visiting for the first time in December 2003. It was the first time I was able to see the motherland. It was the first time my mother was seeing her country for 23 years. And there was just a connection with Iraq ever since.
Marcin, what about you?
My story isn't very different. I was in Minneapolis and I was quite young at the time as well. And actually, a few months ago, I found an old diary of mine from the Iraq War. And I have an entry for when Saddam Hussein was found that was very confused and ecstatic. I was a child then. I was in the US following the news, hearing a lot of what my parents and people around me were saying, but also filled with this idea that we would finally be able to go to this mystical home that we've always been hearing about. And I actually got to go very quickly. I was in Iraq in June 2003. I remember the borders were staffed by American soldiers at the time. So I got to see the earliest days of the occupation and the invasion. Of course, from the perspective of someone who really was quite young and didn't understand exactly what was happening, and who was very much affected by the optimism in the air, particularly in the parts of Iraq my family is from, which is in the south.
So what did it feel like? You're relatively young children. You grew up hearing Arabic. Did you grow up speaking Arabic? Was it easy to fit in? And did it feel totally different from the United States? Or was there enough of an American presence with the troops and everything else that you kind of had a U.S.-mediated experience when you're on the ground?
I grew up in a household where we spoke Arabic at home. So it wasn't too different. I mean, looking back, remembering seeing soldiers in Iraq and having now worked here for the past 4 years.
You're talking to us from Baghdad. So here you mean in Baghdad.
Right. Yeah, here in Baghdad. So after I completed my master's in 2019, I moved to Baghdad and started working there, having visited the country often from 2003 till then. But when you're here every day on the ground, experiencing it, it's different from visiting. Even if you're visiting for work, when you're here for a long period, it becomes a more familiar place to you. And so when you do reflect on the time when there was an occupation, you question of how strange that must have been for the local Iraqis.
Marcin, what was it like for you? Here you're an American and you're seeing American troops. You're Iraqi. But for most Iraqis, American troops are really foreign. So as you were a child, what did the occupation feel like?
It was the first time that I saw the American army as something terrifying because they didn't know I was American. I was with my family in these cars and we would be driving throughout the South or to different provinces in Iraq. And you would have to park your car to the side and just not move if there was an American vehicle going by. And they're very imposing and very terrifying. And you'd hear about them targeting other cars that had moved. And it's not like your passport was like on the car. It didn't really matter whether I was American or not from the perspective of what it was like to be in Iraq then. Obviously, it was very jarring to go back and forth between the US and Iraq over the years. And it was very difficult to watch my parents see Iraq for the first time in years, both of them having left in the early 90s at the beginning of the sanctions. The minute they laid eyes on Baghdad, they were devastated because it looked very beat down. And I remember buildings were burnt and it was just in a state of utter chaos and decay. And for them, it was this beautiful city. And it was like seeing your home demolished. And it was hard for me to see the war through their eyes. I didn't really have an idea of what Iraq was like. I was born there, but I left when I was three. So I don't have a memory. And when I saw it for the first time, I didn't know what to compare with. I just know that very quickly, the Americans became a very imposing force in the country. And there was a brief period, people don't talk about this as much, of euphoria. Maybe not across all of Iraq, but definitely in southern Iraq. Saddam Hussein was a horribly oppressive dictator who had killed so many people and had caused so much chaos that people were genuinely happy to see him gone there. And for a brief time, they were happy to even see the Americans there, but that was very short-lived.
As an American, did Iraqis sort of blame you for the excesses of the American government, of American troops? Did Iraqis seek to use you as an intermediary to speak to Americans or understand what the Americans are really trying to do? Did you end up playing that bridge role?
Not until I decided to become a political scientist and kind of offered myself up inadvertently to play this role where it's like, you know, Marcine, can you say this to the State Department? Can you write about this? Can you do that? But I've never been treated by Iraqis who knew that I was raised in the US as anything but a potential mediator or conduit. There's never been any animosity towards me for being American. And to be honest, there's never been any animosity that I felt from Iraqis towards the average American. I think people think that, especially Americans who have never visited Iraq, that if they came to Iraq, the first reaction of Iraqis would be to be angry at them and to hate them. But from my American friends who have visited, who are very visibly white American, it's been nothing but a very welcoming experience for them. And I think that does say a lot about a certain maturity in the Iraqi street of who to pin this war on and who to pin these experiences on.
How has the country changed since you first went? Marcine points out Baghdad was a war zone. There's a lot of damage. There's obviously physical reconstruction, but there's also a way in which the country now sees a dictatorship very much in the rearview mirror. As you've seen Iraq change, what are the most striking changes that you notice?
Iraq is a very young population, so a lot of people that live in Iraq today don't remember Saddam Hussein, or they grew up with the 2003 war. And so that's left a lasting impact on them. And I think there's a lot of, with the older generation, I can tell you what's interesting when you talk to them was they'll compare different occupations, the British, for example, with the American, point at Bridge X or Building B and tell you, this is what the British built when they occupied us. I can't point to anything that the Americans did for us. So it's interesting what different generations can reflect on.
Marcine, what's changed?
Seemingly overnight, what's happened is there's this new generation of Iraqis who I know my cousins are in this generation who were born in the late 90s or early 2000s who have no memory of Saddam Hussein, like Hamza said, no memory of Baathism, no idea what it really is like to live under that kind of police state. Don't get me wrong, they live in an environment in which there's not a complete freedom of speech and expression. We've seen this in contemporary Iraq right now. But they truly don't have the memory of Iraq as that very typical Arab dictatorship that Saddam Hussein imposed. And because of that, there's this sense of nostalgia for the strong man because they feel that Iraq is very weak, that its borders are constantly being transgressed upon. And they're almost nostalgic for Saddam Hussein or someone like him because they think, look at the Iraqi army back then. It would have never succumbed to ISIS. Or look at the law and order back then. No one would ever accept a bribe, which isn't true, but the idea that the Iraqi state is so strong and powerful and imposing that people respected the country, that it wasn't easily swayed by international actors, by Iran or the United States. And so there's this entire generation that compares democracy to an idealized past, but also has even changed as I've lived in Iraq, where it has imposed higher standards of what democracy should look like. They're no longer just satisfied with the fact that they can go out and vote, which their parents had in 2005. For this generation, it's different. And in a way, it's not so bad that they don't have a memory of pre-2003 Iraq, because they also don't need to be shackled by it. They don't necessarily need to be accepting of everything that's happening in the country today simply because it's better than a dictatorial rule by one strong man. But Iraq looks a lot different in 2023 than it does in 2003. But I can also say I was very young during Ba'athist Iraq, and I spent it almost entirely in the US. But I do have memory of how my mother, for example, communicated with her family during the time. And I remember the shadow of the police state reaching me even in the US, feeling that you had to be very careful about what you said on the phone because you don't want to get your family in danger. And I compare that to the drastic change in 2003 and onwards, in which you walk around Iraq and you can say anything you want about nearly any political figure. But John, I kid you not, I sit in the most armed group controlled areas of Baghdad and talk to journalists about armed groups without worrying. And I find that remarkable compared to when I was 6 and 7 and afraid of telling my grandmother certain things on the phone because she lived in that kind of environment. So it's a completely different place. And it's incredible that I got to see all these versions of Iraq, and I'm very interested to see what the next 20 years brings.
Do you both feel that there are scars left behind by Saddam Hussein? You talked about how there's a new generation that's not really afraid. Hamza talked about how people look sort of cynically at this is what this occupier built and this is what that occupier built. But in terms of the memories you have, Marcin, of things as a six-year-old you knew you shouldn't mention to your grandmother, do you sense that there still are scars left behind, that there are instincts that Iraqis have because of decades of dictatorship by Saddam Hussein that even liberation doesn't eliminate? Marcin?
So I think one of the legacies of Ba'athism is the fact that, and it's not just Ba'athism alone, it's actually a legacy of Ba'athism and international politics. I think the thing that has had the most impact on Iraqi society is the sanctions. It created such a dog-eat-dog world, such an environment of mistrust that it prevails in Iraq today. You asked us in the beginning if we felt like we were visibly foreign or different when we came to Iraq in 2003 and onwards. I speak Arabic with a very clear Iraqi accent. I can blend in when it comes to just speaking and expressing myself. But there was a cultural shock that I experienced in 2003, 2004, 2005, every subsequent summer that I came, and that I experienced in full force when I moved here in 2020. And these, to me, can be traced back to the environment of the sanctions, where there is so much mistrust and fear of other people, of their intentions, just in regular everyday interactions. You're buying something, you're hailing a cab, from a time period in which Iraqis had very limited resources and could trust absolutely no one. And I do put that on Ba'athism and on the sanctions.
So Hamza, it's interesting to me that Marcin sees this as a consequence of sanctions and not of a dictatorial rule. She talked about how she was concerned as a six-year-old talking to her grandmother, but the lingering aspects of trust, she thinks, is not from the dictatorship, but instead from the sanctions. Does that sync with the way you see things?
Definitely. I mean, I remember when Russia invaded Ukraine last year, Iraqis could relate to that, both as those who invaded Kuwait in 91 or being invaded by the US in 2003. And it was when the international community started sanctioning Russia, I remember hearing a lot of Iraqis saying, okay, now the Russians are going to feel it. And it actually gives them a lot of sympathies, even to other countries that are being sanctioned. For example, Iran, a lot of animosity from the 1980 to 88 Iran-Iraq war, but there's still a sense of these people shouldn't be sanctioned. Or even when it came to vilifying of the Russian people, they remembered how they were vilified and sanctioned for the actions of a dictator. And as Marcin mentioned, in your everyday life in Iraq, you can see traces of the sanctions that linger with Iraqis, such as the mistrust, such as I got to take what I can get before it might be gone kind of mentality.
You talked about going to Iraq really as children for the first time. How long did it take before you decided that this was a place you wanted to really be deeply connected with for the rest of your lives, that you wanted a professional connection with Iraq? Was that something that you immediately felt, or was it something that developed through university and as you thought more deeply about what you wanted to do?
For me, it really impacted my life. From the get-go, I always knew from middle school I wanted to study political science when I get to university, and that focus would be on Iraq, both as a way to kind of understand how Iraq got to where it is, but also to look forward to, okay, what's happened has happened. We didn't have a say in that. But now that Iraqis have more control of their country, then maybe there's an opportunity to take part in that, to influence policy.
For me, my parents, when they were forced to move to the US, particularly my mother, she never really wanted to stay there. She kept thinking soon we'll be able to go back. Eventually, you know, Saddam Hussein will die or something will let up and we'll be able to go back. And so I grew up thinking that the US is temporary, even though I was American in many ways, but also very Iraqi because I thought eventually we'd be able to return. I actually resisted studying politics and studying Iraq for a very long time, up until deep into college, where I was interested in various different topics, but I gravitated without really realizing always towards questions that stemmed from Iraq, never in direct ways. So, for example, I had written a thesis at Wellesley, which examined how clerics responded to an uprising in 1991. And the reason I wrote about that is because my dad and a lot of his friends had participated as like young men in this uprising and felt deeply betrayed by clerics and always complained about it. And so I always wanted to understand these things. And so I very much resisted and wasn't happy, but inadvertently pushing myself closer and closer until I basically had a PhD in Iraqi politics. Unlike Hamza, I was not very eager. But I think something that Hamza and I both share, probably why we're married, is that we both feel in a way responsible to be voices for Iraq because we grew up with Iraq being voiceless and powerless.
So as you say, you both have spent a lot of time thinking about Iraq. You both work trying to understand Iraqi politics. What do you two disagree about when it comes to Iraqi politics? Marcin, what does Hamza just not understand that you're still trying to persuade him of?
Well, there's what does Hamza not understand versus am I still trying to persuade him of it? Those are two different questions. I think we disagree on how likely authoritarian retrenchment is, where I would say Hamza's a greater optimist than I am. And there's something that we really haven't, I think, decided on, but there's a lot of tension about whether you should accept certain figures in the status quo, not just in Iraq, but in any other government, for the purpose of stability and seeing things through versus whether you should take a stand on every single thing. There's this tension between being a scholar and an activist. But Hamza, you tell me, did I characterize that right?
Yeah, I think I am more of an optimist on Iraq, but that's just my nature. And even if I wasn't optimistic, I guess I have a feeling of responsibility. I've met a lot of Iraqis that aren't really hopeful. And I say, but what choice do you have? This is the country you have, and this is what we've got to work with. So it's a sense of responsibility and a sense of hope. And I just hope that no one loses that hope, because I remember growing up, there was no hope for Iraq under Saddam. And the price has been tremendous to pay to get that hope. And so 20 years on, I hear a lot about when I'm in Washington or other places about Iraq fatigue. It's difficult to cope up. At various points of your life, Iraq's on the headlines everywhere you go. And then various other points, no one really cares. But I believe Iraq is still important because of what it can offer to the region. We're seeing democracies crumble around us. And so Iraq, despite our challenges, I still see it as a democratizing state. And when I look towards Americans, I remind them of the price they've had to pay to not give up. And then when I look to Iraqis, I remind them that I believe democracy is the best path forward. We don't need to pursue it just to please the Americans or someone else. It's for our own sake. And so balancing those two things out to try to reach a better place for Iraq.
But let me ask you a question about the future. We're 20 years past the invasion, and it still feels like Iraq is in a state of transition. What do you think Iraq will look like 20 years from now? What kinds of transitions do you think will be consolidated? What kinds of new trends? So, Marcin, we're 20 years in. Give us another 20 years. What do you think the situation is going to be?
That's a tough question. 20 years is actually not a very long time in the life of a country. 20 years will flash by very quickly. And not to sound like a cliche, I do think Iraq is at a crossroads, but I don't think the cross point has to be like a flash moment. It's a series of decisions that can take the country in two different directions broadly. I think one series of decisions is ones that are oriented towards building the country and making it resilient to future challenges, including the challenges of climate change and of oil being no longer so lucrative. To accomplish this, you'll need a series of administrations which are willing to work on specific issues, which are willing to invest in diversifying the economy and in seeking water diplomacy to ensure that we don't have these dry basins in the south anymore. And this won't be the work of 2 years. It'll be the work of 4 to 6 to 8 years. And we're not in this time going to get a leader who is going to be resistant to pressures from Iran and the US and, you know, a reformer who's youthful and everyone loves him. It's not going to happen. This is going to happen within the political system we have right now, which is one in which you have to try to please as many people to push through minimal reforms. And so it's a difficult path, but I do think it's a pragmatic thing to do for the political elite to invest in this, because Iraq is facing an existential crisis. Basra is becoming uninhabitable. And I will say Baghdad in the summer is nearly uninhabitable. They're facing a crisis of internal displacement. They're facing a crisis where the population has already demonstrated that they're so angry that they're willing to launch a month-long protest movement. And I think the political elite, as corrupt and as nefarious as they are, will be pragmatic in minimal ways and perhaps try to mitigate this. That's one possible scenario. What it looks like in 20 years is Iraq, at best, might have a small opposition in parliament of non-partisans, of independents, barely pushing along reforms that matter to society, still pushing against the conservative grain. And then the other route that can easily go down as well, and one that has been developing, is what I call sub-state authoritarianism, in which leaders of particular governorates or groups of governorates forge their own fiefdoms in which they stifle freedom of speech and they become a strong man within a region, within a federal system that's not very effective at imposing rule and order over the entire country, which some areas are going to be open to predation by armed actors or going to be entirely run by them. And you see hints of this. For example, the Kurdistan region of Iraq basically is a sub-state authoritarian system. People say it's run by two political families, but it essentially is looking like it's being run by a single political family at this point. And it looks a lot different from the rest of Iraq, but you're also slowly seeing this develop in Anbar, in Western Iraq, with the current Speaker of Parliament, Mohammed al-Halbousi, and his rivalry with local leaders there. And it might coalesce into something that looks like sub-state authoritarianism there. So you can imagine that something like that could develop. And then Iraq in 20 years will look like small fiefdoms run by former oil barons, oligarchs, and particular families with a very weak structure in the federal system, constantly infringed on by neighboring states, by Iran and Turkey, always susceptible to shocks across the country, but probably stable within the regions. Those are the two competing visions.
Hamza has a third vision, which I would guess is more optimistic.
Much more optimistic. We're looking at 20 years since the Iraq invasion, but Iraq went through a civil war in 2006 and the invasion of ISIS in 2014. So if you tell me in 20 years, we're still having regular elections, freedom of speech maintains itself, and that we have no violence, then I'll take it. I'm saying this is, we're making strides in Iraq in 20 years. What gives me hope in that is 2 days ago, I met with someone that's grew up and born and raised in Baghdad, was 7 when the war happened, and he's doing his master's at the University of Baghdad. And I asked him, did you ever have chances of leaving throughout these different turbulent times? And he said, yeah, I did, but I never wanted to. And I said, is there any reason now that you'd ever think about leaving? And he said, no, I'm very optimistic. The one thing that might force me to leave is climate change. And that gave me a hope that this is a person that for all that they've seen, their next worry is climate change. And maybe if there's other Iraqis like them who can galvanize that energy and it harbors that energy to something good.
As a final question, as there's become a consensus in the United States that the Iraq War was a strategic mistake for the United States, as Iraqis, as an Iraqi American, Iraqi Canadian, what's your response to Americans who say the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake?
Hamza and I were talking about this today. I continuously marvel over what pushed the United States to invade Iraq. And I told him, was it just stupidity in the foreign policy community that they actually thought that they could create a democratic system that would be anti-Iran and pro-Israel? What hallucinations did they have of like Iraq's potential that flew against the grain of everything we know from political science? Was it being extremely uninformed? Or is there something we just don't know and that will be revealed with more declassification of documents in the future? So I'm looking forward to reading more and more of what actually happened internally in the lead up to this war, because I genuinely don't understand the rationale behind it.
I've always seen it as this was something out of my hands personally and out of Iraqis' hands for the most part. And so what's done is done, and how do we move on? And how do we rebuild this country to the way we like it, to the way we want it? And I think that's first and foremost the most important thing for Iraqis, and to not lose sight of that. However, it is so important to look back on that decision. And while we learn about the mistakes of it, to not continue building on it, to not isolate Iraq again, just because in this election, there's certain politicians that have been elected and Washington doesn't like them, but to actually fully understand the hard and long process that democratization is, and that democracy in Iraq isn't necessarily going to give you the most pro-American government, but it's also probably not going to give you the most pro-Iranian government. And to just accept that, you know, we are a country that has different political parties, different political beliefs. We're still getting back on our feet. We're still figuring ourselves out. I mean, we're still debating the type of elections we should have. We are still debating about whether to boycott them or not. Iraqis are having this conversation. And so maybe for non-Iraqis to take a step back and listen to the Iraqis have this conversation, for the Iraqis to urge them to continue this democratic culture of discussion, of debate, and to build on the good that has happened since 2003. There's been a lot of bad things, but there has been some good things, and you can only look forward.
Mersin Ashemri, Hamza Haddad from Baghdad, thank you very much for joining us on Babel.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
So I really appreciate that Mersin and Hamza joined you, John, for the conversation, because I feel like so much of what they shared, it was very personal listening to their story from childhood all the way to adulthood and how they kind of relate to Iraq, but also their new homelands. So I was curious if either one of you found any particular moments or revelations in your conversation to be surprising, especially about how they view their connection to Iraq.
I was actually really surprised that they felt an instant connection. It seems to me that you might expect that they had always expected a foreign place to be home, and you get there and you realize it's actually very foreign. And I've certainly spoken to Arab Americans who've arrived in the Arab world and say, this actually isn't home for me. And what was really striking to me is they grew up really in exile, feeling like they were growing up in exile. And when they went back, there was that immediate sense that they were home. There was an immediate sense of connection, despite the fact that this is a country that was still emerging from war. And to go from a place like Minnesota to a place like Iraq, and to go from a place that hasn't known war in hundreds of years to a place that knew war weeks before, I was surprised that it didn't seem more jarring in their memory than it was.
Something that surprised me was when Marcin spoke about how she had consciously avoided trying to focus on Iraq, and that over time she found these themes kind of pulling her back towards it, and then ended up obviously with a PhD in Iraqi politics. I want to be really, really clear here and say I have never lived in exile. I am not from a country that has experienced conflict, certainly in my lifetime. But I think there is something interesting about this idea that your experiences and what you grow up surrounded by, you may only want to sort of study these things later on in your life, perhaps when you're a bit removed from the situation, where you can start to consider them in a slightly different light, but that these experiences and memories and whatnot are working away. And I think about this in terms of rising far-right nationalism and some of these other sort of themes that clearly have shaped Britain, where I'm from, in recent years. But when I was living in the UK, I didn't really see that very much. I live in a bubble, and it's only sort of coming to the US, and then I can step back and reconsider our relationship with some of these other themes.
And it's interesting to have that sense of distance. I have a friend who's a journalist, was working in China, and he said that it's really hard when you're working in China to get people in China to say really helpful things about China. And part of that is because of a sense of censorship, but also there's not enough distance, not enough perspective. And he felt, ironically, that the best people were think tanks like CSIS, because you're forced to separate the signal from the noise, and you're not overwhelmed by data in the same way. I think Marcin and Hamza both grew up in Arabic-speaking households. When they went out, they were able to really blend in. But I'm sure on the inside, they always had a sense of newness, a sense of distance. One of the things we have to think about as analysts, and I think we all think about all the time, is what's the appropriate distance? You don't want total distance, and we all know people in Washington who analyze things overseas with total distance. You also know people who just have no perspective. And I think that the challenge, and they've been really interesting striking this balance, is how do you have enough intimacy to recognize what you're seeing that's interesting, but how do you have enough distance that it doesn't all get overwhelmed by so many small details that ultimately in the long run aren't that important?
You know, as Dr. Shamri was speaking, all I could think of was when I was back home, and it was after the revolution, and I was on the opposite end of where she is. And so
this is in Libya.
In Libya, yes. And so I saw the Libyan exiled diaspora come back, and we could clearly point them out. And it wasn't because of the way they were dressed or how they spoke. It was the optimism they came back with, the energy that they came back with, because the rest of us were so exhausted, so jaded by everything. We knew that the system was in complete anarchy. We knew that this wasn't going to take 2 or 3 years. We knew that it's not going to be as simple, because we've been there for the last 2, 3, 4 decades. And we were aware of how much distrust was on the ground and how much the fabric of our community had begun to disintegrate the last few years. And what makes me a little sad is as time went by, you can see them lose steam because they were coming to the same conclusions that we've come to.
It was interesting because Marcin talked quite openly about the deterioration of trust. She ascribed it to sanctions. Libya, of course, was under sanctions for many decades. But I don't think most Americans think about that aspect of how American policy affects the way other societies work. As we think about sanctions, it's all directed to the government. And I thought it was very interesting and to me surprising that Marcin felt that, that these sanctions really did have a profound impact on how Iraqis related to each other. And again, I think you have to grow up in Minnesota in a place where there's a different level of trust. It takes a certain kind of sensitivity to see that and to understand where the connections are.
Yeah. And I met with a Libyan friend a few weeks ago, and she was born and raised here in Tennessee. And the only Libya she only ever heard about was the one through her parents' eyes. And she grew up with this romanticized version of Libya. So after the revolution, she was telling me just how disappointed she was to land and not recognize Libya through her parents' eyes. And then she saw as her father got depressed, realizing that the country he left behind 20, 30 years ago after being in exile is no longer there. So that's definitely something that the diaspora kind of grapples with. It's so strange to build so much of your identity on memories of a place that was once there, but then when you revisit it and you feel like it's no longer there, then what does that do to your own identity?
But then there are also there are remarkable ways in which diaspora communities can create futures, which would be unimaginable to people who have only grown up in certain kinds of environments.
Yeah, and we need that optimism, for sure.
But exchange programs and overseas education have transformed thousands and thousands of lives.
And investment as well. A lot of diaspora communities really lead investment earlier than companies are willing to invest after a conflict or whatnot. They're driven maybe by they see business opportunities, but I think a lot of them are driven by a personal desire to try and improve and make a difference in the community that they were from. I saw this in Lebanon. One of the cases that I cite in Power and Recovery is about this largely Spanish-speaking town because it has such strong ties to the Lebanese diaspora in Latin America. And it was that diaspora that funded their first solar project in this town.
I mean, it's complicated, and the challenge for both the diaspora community and also for the home communities, how do you balance that? I was friends with Anthony Shadid, tragically died as a reporter for the New York Times, getting smuggled out of Syria. But he did a book about his own experience rebuilding his grandfather's house in Lebanon called House of Stone. And I thought there was so much universal in that book about Anthony's relationship as an Arab American, never totally felt 100% American. He grew up in Oklahoma, always felt a little bit like an outsider, went back to Lebanon and realized he was always going to speak Arabic with an accent. They were always going to try to take advantage of him. He was never really going to be from there either. And what I find really remarkable about this book is Anthony coming to terms with that tension. Third generation American, definitely felt strongly Arab American, but felt strongly Arab and strongly American, and I think had to reconcile the fact that he was never going to resolve that tension. Tragically, he died just before the book was released.
So to bring us all to a conclusion, I want to quickly revisit when Marcin spoke about how it was actually sanctions that left a lasting scar on the Iraqi population and not Baathism. And seeing as how the U.S. and the international community in general are pushing for sanctions on or regimes in Iran, in Syria, what do you think policymakers could possibly learn from the Iraqi experience of sanctions?
I think there's a broader set of lessons on sanctions, which to my mind have to be learned, which is longstanding sanctions don't actually change government behavior. Under longstanding sanctions, governments create workarounds. Oftentimes, the bad guys are precisely the ones who are benefiting from the sanctions busting. And rather than contributing to change, you inhibit change. But how do you know when you've reached that point? And when you are dealing with an authoritarian government and you're trying to change the behavior, how do you realize that you're reaching a point of diminishing returns? To me, that's the important issue. the issue of, do you have societies that don't have trust, whether the lack of trust is a consequence of the sanctions or relentless authoritarianism and censorship, or the government instrumentalizing the hardship and saying this is because of the sanctions when actually it's because of bad governance. I'm not sure where the balance comes out. But to me, the thing that we have to wrap our heads around is oftentimes the easiest thing to do is say, we're just going to impose sanctions. We're going to impose sanctions. And it's so much easier to impose sanctions than lift them. And when you have enough sanctions, you end up inhibiting a lot of the change you're trying to create because you undermine the people who would want to advocate for a closer relationship with you. And you inadvertently strengthen the very people who are doing all the offensive things that you're trying to undermine. So to me, that's the sort of lesson. It doesn't so much have to do with, are we going to create trusting societies in targeted countries? Because A, that's not the point of the sanctions. And B, under an authoritarian government, I'm not sure how the U.S. can do that. But to me, there is this issue of thinking more holistically about how sanctions work and finding ways not to just put on another coat of paint, another coat of paint, another coat of paint, another coat of paint. Because after a while, you realize you have no tools left. One of my favorite anecdotes is we had sanctions against Syria that required the president to choose between a number of sanctions to impose. And one of the sanctions that President Clinton imposed was he said that Syrian Arab Airlines couldn't fly to the United States. Well, at the time, Syrian Arab Airlines didn't have a plane that could reach the United States. And it just descends into farce.
I agree. But then the challenge is, if you realize that sanctions aren't bringing about the desired results, how do you lift them in a way that can be productive and doesn't look like a complete walk back? And then if you sort of establish this idea that you will try sanctions for a period, and then if they don't work, then you lift them, then presumably that only encourages future authoritarian regimes around the world to just try and stick it out. So I agree with you, John. I am no fan of just more and more sanctions, but these are really tricky things. Once you've started using them, as you say, it's very hard to lift them.
As you say, in the signaling that the targeted regimes claim this is a victory, and rather than advance your interests, you end up setting them back.
From a local perspective, on the trust issue, I've never necessarily viewed it as a trust issue within the Libyan society, like trust between one another, because we were under sanctions up until the early 2000s. And the regime had a very heavy media campaign where it was never referred to as sanctions. It was always the hisar, the embargo, which made it easier for us to envision the U.S. as the aggressor, that everything that we are going under is because of them. And as a child in the 90s, I was 9 and 10, I clearly remember the economic hardships my parents and everyone around us went through. But what strikes me is, afterwards, when they were lifted, we were left with a sense of confusion as to what the U.S. and the international community's stance towards the Gaddafi regime is, because some of us who never agreed with the regime's tactics and knew of the oppression and wanted change were now fearful, because they were rehabilitating him, they were reintroducing him to the international stage, and they lifted the sanctions, and we were just wondering, what does this all mean? Why are they going back and forth? And then when the revolution happened, and the U.S. got involved, and the West got involved, and then when they came down on the ground with donor relationships, we were still not sure how to deal with them. So that was the kind of distrust that we were left with. They never gave us clear signals on where they stood. And it's why, in my opinion, we continue to have a very complex relationship with them, and we're not able to move forward together. On that note, thank you both, John and Will, for a great conversation.
Thank you, Libna.
Thanks, Libna.
Thanks for listening to Babbel. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find more analysis on this topic linked in the show notes on the CSIS website, and you can find us on Twitter at CSIS Mideast.